It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The pilgrims came to New England because it seemed to be relatively empty. They could do whatever they wanted, no one would bother them. America represented a fresh page and especially a clean slate. They just wanted to get out of England.
They came for freedom to create a godly city, a place where you could live a pure life, a perfect life under God's rules.
If the pilgrims had known what they were in for, they almost certainly wouldn't have done it. They were really on their own, and they had this very tenuous lifeline back to England.
It was an incredibly inhospitable environment in terms of climate. New England, of course, had very cold weather in the winter, and so it was very, very difficult for the settlers early on.
And that first year was devastating for them. They were dying of starvation. They were dying of disease.
One of the things the pilgrims discovered relatively early on was how little they knew about how to farm. They discovered that the Indians were farmers too. And because relations between the pilgrims and the Indians were relatively good at the beginning, there was an exchange of technology.
And the Native Americans really helped them, and you have this period of cooperation between the two groups.
They learn that what you have to do is put the seed in the ground, but if you put a fish head along with that, it will grow much better.
Must have been a strange and curious and wonderful thing to see people using fish meal to make the soil more productive and things grow faster and more abundantly.
It is not just a one-way trade, there will also be the other way of new European crops coming into the New World.
But if it weren't for the Native American communities, the pilgrims would have been wiped out.
The success of the pilgrims and their descendants was beyond their imagination. And the country that emerged from this is one of the most successful in world history. So it's not at all surprising that Americans have this belief that America is exceptional.
Sandy Rios with you to celebrate this Thanksgiving 2017. There has been no story in the history of man about the founding of a country like the story of what happened with America's founders. And so the story needs to be retold, and we're going to tell it on this Thanksgiving 2017. I don't know how, I don't care how many times you've heard it. We're going to tell it again because it is a great, great story. And of course, the faith of our founding fathers, their faith in Jesus Christ specifically, is woven so intricately into the founding of this country, into the celebration of that first Thanksgiving, oh, so very long ago. I can't think of anyone, by the way, to help tell this story than William Federer. Bill is an American writer. He's written, I know, at least 30 books. I don't really know the final count. We'll ask him that, but he is his historian. He travels all over the world lecturing about America's story, and I've asked him to join us to celebrate this Thanksgiving 2017. Good morning, Bill.
Sandy, great to be with you.
All right, so Bill, Thanksgiving sort of took place. It wasn't when the founders came, but it was close after that. Tell us a little bit about that story. You know, like if we were sitting at your feet, because if I were your child or your daughter or your grandchild, I'd certainly want my grandchildren at your feet to tell the story. I know you've told it a million times, but tell it to us again, Bill.
Well, thank you, Sandy. Big picture, small picture. The big picture is Islam, after Muhammad, conquered North Africa. There used to be 250 Catholic dioceses along North Africa. Boom, conquered. Then they invade Spain, hold it for 700 years. Then they conquer the Middle East, conquer into Turkey. All seven churches mentioned in the Book of Revelation were wiped out. And then they are surrounding Vienna, Austria in 1529. Well, just earlier than that, 1517, you have Martin Luther, and he starts the Reformation. So the Catholic Holy Roman Emperor is Charles V of Spain, and he is faced with a double dilemma. Protestant Reformation on one hand, started by Martin Luther in 1517, Muslim invasion on the other hand, with 100,000 Muslims surrounding Vienna in 1529. So he does something unique. He strikes a deal with the Protestants. It's called the Peace of Augsburg of 1555. And in this Peace of Augsburg is a little Latin phrase that had enormous repercussions. The phrase was, Cuius regio, eius religio, which means, whose is the reign, his is the religion. In other words, look, Protestant king, believe whatever you want in your kingdom. Let's just work together against these Muslims who are invading Europe because they want to kill us all. And it stopped the invasion, but it started this domino effect of different kings believing different things. So Northern Germany and Sweden were Lutheran, Switzerland Calvinist, Scotland Presbyterian, Holland Dutch Reformed, England was Anglican, Greece was Greek Orthodox, Russia was Russian Orthodox, and of course, Italy, Spain, France, Austria, Poland, Ireland remained Catholic. But if you did not believe the way your particular king did, you were persecuted, you fled. And so suddenly, Europe was thrown into this mass migration of people group shifting all around, simply for conscience sake. So again, prior to the Islamic invasion, all of Western Europe was Catholic. After this Muslim invasion was so serious, Charles V was pressured to make this deal with the Protestants that it let every king believe what they wanted. So we'll focus in a little bit on England. It had a king named Henry VIII. He was Catholic, and he was married to Catherine of Aragon, the daughter of the king and queen of Spain. Pretty important girl, right? Because her father was the most powerful man in the world. Well, after 18 years, Henry decides to divorce Catherine of Aragon. She did not have a son. Had a daughter, Mary, but not a son. Well, the Pope won't recognize the divorce because she is, after all, the daughter of the most powerful guy in the world. Plus, Charles V, the next Spanish king, had invaded Italy and imprisoned the Pope for 6 months. So he's not in any hurry to get on the wrong side of Spain. So he refuses to acknowledge Henry's divorce. Henry says, you know what? I'm just going to declare myself my own Pope. He starts the Church of England, puts himself on as the head, and goes on to have six wives, not at the same time, but their fates were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. So Henry VIII was not a really nice guy to be married to. Well, when he was Catholic, he had William Tyndale burnt at the stake for what? For translating the Bible into English. But now, 1534, he wants to marry Anne Boleyn. She doesn't want to be a mistress, so she insists that he's got to officially marry her. And so he starts this Church of England. His advisors suggest to Henry, if he really wants to go through with this split from Rome, he's got to stop using that Latin Bible. And so he said, oh, okay, get me an English Bible. Well, they basically take William Tyndale's translation, who Henry had killed, and William Tyndale's last words were, Lord, open the King of England's eyes. But they take William Tyndale's translation and they put it together in what's called the Great Bible. And the cover page has this beautiful engraving of Henry VIII sitting on the throne, handing the Bible to the clergy and to the lords and so forth. And he goes, ooh, I like that. And he has 11,000 copies of it spread all around England, thinking this will do it. This will solidify my political separation from Rome. But something unexpected happened. People began to read it and began to compare what's in this Bible that they can now read with this king divorcing and beheading his wives and claiming to be the head of the church. And so a group started that wanted to purify the Church of England. They were nicknamed the Puritans. The king obviously didn't think he needed purifying. And so he eventually got an Anglican archbishop named William Laud, L-A-U-D, and he would send spies into the churches, listen to their sermons. If they didn't preach what the king wanted, the pastor was arrested. Sort of like the lesbian mayor of Houston that wanted to censor all the sermons of all the pastors, right? Or sort of like the IRS wanting to listen to the sermons of the pastors. And so they had the Star Chamber, which where you were drug into this chamber and you were forced to testify against yourself. They would cut off your ear. They'd brand you on the face with SL for seditious libel. And they had stars on the ceiling. And so they called it the Star Chamber. So the king had this pass, this act of uniformity. He says, okay, we're not going to be Catholic, but you have to worship according to my King's Anglican Church. Now, Henry dies. Henry VIII dies. His daughter, Mary, takes over and tries to make England Catholic again, kills a bunch of people, so she's nicknamed Bloody Mary. A son of Henry's, Edward, takes over for a couple years, and he dies when he's just a teenager. And then you have Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, and she's there with William Shakespeare, Francis Drake, who circles the world after Magellan, Francis Bacon with the Scientific Revolution. And Elizabeth sort of does this balancing act, you know, sort of keeps some of the Catholic stuff and then some of the Protestant stuff. And then the Pope actually excommunicates her. So she goes, okay, I guess I am Anglican all the way. And but Elizabeth does this, this again, a balancing act. And so during her reign, you have lots of these Protestant groups have a lot of freedom. But then you get James I, and he does this uniformity thing to the hilt. I mean, he says that everybody has to believe exactly the way he does, or he's going to, quote, harry them out of the land. So now we're up to the Pilgrims. So you had these Puritans wanting to purify the Church of England, and then you had these separatists. And these are people that say, hey, it's beyond hope of trying to purify the Church of England. We are going to separate ourselves. And they would meet in secret in barns and basements by candlelight and so forth. They eventually flee to Holland, and then they eventually flee to America. We call them the Pilgrims. Now, it's important to also point out Spain was the power keeping Islam in check. Spain was using the gold from the New World, right? Peru and the Incan Empire, and funneling all that gold to the Spanish Empire to fit out their navy to stop the Muslims from taking over the Mediterranean and from invading Europe. The big Battle of Lepanto, 1571, where 230 Muslim ships are stopped by the 200 Holy League ships. After stopping Islam, Spain, instead of freeing up the rest of the Mediterranean from the Muslims, they decide to take their military and squash the Reformation in Holland and in England. In Holland, 1572, it's called the Spanish Furies, and the Iron Duke, the Duke of Alba, goes up there to Antwerp and is just having his men butcher and pillage and kill these Protestants. Well, in 1588, King Philip of Spain sends his invincible Spanish armada to England. These enormous ships, three levels of cannon, thousands and thousands of troops. And what's he going to do? He's going to take this Protestant England and bring it back under Spain and under the Catholic Church. And if he would have been successful, there would have been no more Puritans, there would have been no separatists, and there would have been no Pilgrims, and there would have been no founding of America like we had it. And America would have just been an extension of Mexico. Well, what happened was the Spanish Armada...
You know what, Jim, Bill, I'm going to interrupt and just say, don't tell us yet, because we're going to take a break, because this is fascinating. You know, we've just been talking about... Last week, we talked a great deal about the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, and I hinted at that time on the effect that it had on the foundings of this country. But honestly, Bill, I'd never known to the extent that you're teaching us today about what the links are. And it reminds me, as you're telling the story, how some things never change. You know, who is the greatest enemy? Let's see, Christians or the Islamists? Christians or the Islamists? This is kind of where we are now with the left. So that's kind of musing in a very dark way. But it is Thanksgiving 2017, and we do have such an incredible story, and I can't think of anyone better, as you know now, to tell it than Bill Federer. So we'll return right after this for more of our great story. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
I don't know what you're doing. Whatever you're doing, you've got Thanksgiving on your mind, I'm sure. Whether it's time with family, it's the meal, whatever is occupying you this day, Thanksgiving 2017. But surely all of us have so much to be thankful for. And at the same time, we remember all of our fellow Americans who are experiencing the first Thanksgiving without a loved one. We have had so much bloodshed in this past year. It is unfathomable. So as we thank God for our many blessings, and surely they are many, we need to also remember people who are suffering grief over these holidays for the loss of loved ones, people that are alone. I don't need to fill in the blanks. You know what grief is. And so let's remember to remember people who may be struggling to find things to be grateful for this Thanksgiving. But surely we all have many, many things. Our guest is Bill Federer. Bill has just written, by the way, of his many books, he has a current one called Who is the King in America? And Bill, before you go on with our story, our American story, just give us a little taste of what that's about, that book.
Well, thank you, Sandy. I go through all of world history from the beginning of the invention of writing, Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley, today that's Iraq, and they were begun around 3300 BC. Get any secular history book, and it will say that writing was invented around 3300 BC. And we're around 2080, so that's around 5,000 or 6,000 years of recorded human history, human beings writing down human records, which is not that long. 6,000 years is just 60 people living 100 years each back to back. We've all met someone who's lived 100 years, maybe a grandma. We're talking 60 grandmothers, and you're all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history. It's not that long. But the question I asked was, what's the most common form of government? Let's see. Nimrod, Tower of Babel, Sargon of Akkadia, Gilgamesh, King of Uruk, 2,000 years of Egyptian pharaohs, the Tilgath-Pilaser of Assyria, which was the biggest empire in the world around 2000 BC. Then you have Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon had the biggest empire, but it's outdone by Cyrus, who had the biggest empire, and Darius, and then it's outdone by Alexander the Great, who has the biggest empire. They keep getting bigger. The Roman Empire, Attila the Hun, the Muslim sultans, the Genghis Khan, 1200 AD, conquers from Korea to Hungary, kills 30 million people, and then the maritime empires of Portugal, and then Spain, but ultimately England. Clearly, there's a global goal in mind, and someday there's some dictator willing to get the whole world under their thumb. But when America's founders broke from the King of England, they were breaking away from a globalist. I mean, England controlled all of India, a quarter of the world's population right there, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, British Guiana, Canada, and America. So when America's founders got the chance, they flipped it and made the people the king. So a republic is where the people are king, ruling through representatives. So we pledge allegiance to the flag and to the republic. We're basically pledging allegiance to us being in charge of ourselves. And so when somebody protests the flag, what they're saying is, I don't want to be the king anymore. It's like, okay, you don't want to participate in this system where you get to be a co-regent and help rule. No, I protest. So you want somebody else to rule their life. Anyway, I go through, so in America, the people are king. Where did they get the ideas? Little ancient Greece, ancient Rome, but ultimately ancient Israel. So 1400 BC, Israel comes out of Egypt. That's the first instance in recorded history of a nation with millions of people with no king. And it worked for 400 years. And as long as the priests taught it. And Israel was the first nation with equality. Because wherever there's a king, if you're friends with the king, you're more equal. You're not friends with the king, you're less equal. You're an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason. Or you're a slave. And so ancient Israel, there was no king for 400 years, and the law says there's no respect of persons in judgment. Everyone should be treated the same. That's the beginning of the concept of equality. Israel was the first nation with private land ownership. If there's a king, you never really own the land. It's always conditional of you staying on the nice side of the king. You cross the king, he will take away your land and kill you. In Israel, the land was permanently titled to the families. Israel was the first nation with people getting to own weapons, right? And wherever there's a king, he has an army to enforce his will. In Israel, every man was in the militia and armed and ready at a moment's notice to defend his family and his community. Israel had a bureaucracy-free welfare system. In Egypt, people were selling their souls to the Pharaoh for a handout. In Israel, when people harvested their field, they left the gleanings for the poor. This way, the poor were taken care of without some political leader collecting everything and doling it back out. Israel was the first nation that could read. Only 1% of Egypt could read. Reading and writing was the scribes' secret knowledge. They kept these 3,000 hieroglyphs complicated on purpose as job security. When Moses comes down the mountain, he does not just have the law. He has the law in a 22-character alphabet. So easy to learn, kids could learn how to read. No longer is it the secret knowledge of this elite class. So Israel was a citizen-dependent system. You needed to have a moral and educated populace. So it's a spectrum of power. One side's total government, the other side's no government. Total government, you get a king who rules by fear. No government is anarchy, unless the people have internal morals. Like everybody has a behavioral app that they downloaded on their iPhone, right? Tells them how to act. But wait a second, why would you follow an internal moral? What would motivate you to deny yielding to a selfish temptation? Israel had the key ingredient, a God who is watching everyone. He wants you to be fair, and he will hold you accountable in the future. So you're about to steal, nobody's around, and then you think, God's watching. He wants me to be fair. He's going to hold me accountable. Maybe I should hesitate stealing. And it creates something in your head called a conscience. If everybody in the country believes this, you can maintain complete order with no police. But if you get rid of this God, all you have is rules. Why follow them? Some will out of social acceptance, but others are going to say, forget this. And like taking a bobber off a fishing line and the lead weight hits the bottom of the lake, you're going to have people yielding to their selfish fallen nature, and they're going to start robbing and stealing and smashing windows and setting buildings on fire and having mobs in the street and random shootings. And then people are going to say, well, we need someone to come in with enough power to restore order. And so the government comes in, collects everybody's guns, and yeah, they'll restore order. But when the dust settles, you'll have fundamentally transformed your country from the people ruling themselves from the bottom up to a king ruling from the top down.
All right. So I can see where this is going, Bill. And I mean, that's a great tease for this book. It's who is the king in America? And you've already laid the groundwork. And it sounds, listen, as only you can, I think because you have such great knowledge of history, then the pieces start fitting together and you can see things in a way that other people can't, because we don't know enough of the details of our own history and world history. So this is great. Who is the king in America? And that's the Bill's latest book. Well, Bill, since this is Thanksgiving, you were just telling us about the conflict you said the Spanish had turned their armada against the Protestants rather than turning them against the threat from Islam and the Turks. And then you said if they had prevailed, something. And that's where, when we last spoke about this, you left us on the cliffhanger. Because what exactly did happen?
So we talked about kings, and in the 1500s, the most powerful king in the world was the King of Spain. He controlled all the New World, all the Netherlands, all of Italy. The Philippines are named after his son, King Philip of Spain. And he has the most powerful navy in the world. It's called the Invincible Spanish Armada. The year is 1588, and he's sailing toward England to squash the Reformation. 130 ships, 1,000 iron guns, 1,500 brass guns, 7,000 sailors, 18,000 soldiers, plus he's planning on picking up 30,000 more soldiers from the Spanish Netherlands. Who is in charge of England? Queen Elizabeth. And she gives the most famous speech of her career. Let tyrants fear. I know I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and of a king of England too. And I think foul scorn that Spain or any prince of Europe should dare invade the borders of my realm. I myself will take up arms. I myself will be your general. Your value shall shortly have a famous victory over those enemies of my God, my kingdom, and my people. And so what happened? So the British, together with the Dutch, they are fighting. They have these little bitty ships, but they're faster. And so it's harder for the Spanish ships to catch these little ones. Plus, they lure them to the coast of Holland, and there are these sandbars. And so the Spanish ships get stuck on the sandbars. And then it turns nighttime, and the Spanish put their ships in this half-moon anchored position. Well, a hurricane is beginning to blow. Francis Drake takes some English ships, fills them full of gunpowder, sets them on fire, and they blow into this half-moon area of the Spanish ships being anchored. And so the Spanish hurry up, cut their anchors so their sails all don't get burned up. The hurricane hits, and for the next month, these Spanish armada are smashed on the coast of Scotland and Ireland. When word gets to King Philip, he says, I sent my armada against men, not against God's winds and waves. But once Spain's armada is smashed, it breaks Spain's monopoly on the New World.
Wow.
Adam Smith wrote in The Wealth of Nations, he says, the Spaniards, by virtue of first discovery, claimed all America as their own. The terror of their name, the greater part of the other nations, were afraid to establish themselves. But the defeat of their invincible armada put it out of their power to obstruct any longer the settlement of the other European nations. In the course of the next century, English, French, Dutch, Danes, and Swedes attempted to make some settlements in the New World. So it was like an Oklahoma land rush. All these countries were wanting to hurry up, have New France, New Holland, New Amsterdam, and New England, and settle in the New World. And so now we're building up to the pilgrims coming over.
So, Bill, it is true that much of America's founding was a business interest, you know, building these trading companies, et cetera. That's a whole part of the history, but I'm asking you for clarification. It is not the main reason. I mean, do you believe that trade was the main reason that people went to the New World, or do you believe there was the strongest motivation was something different?
Right. So you have Jamestown, Virginia, and you have the Pilgrims at Plymouth. The Jamestown, there was a question as to what was the real motivation for it. You had the Spanish taking their gold from Portobello, Panama, all the way over to Spain. You had the British captured Jamaica, and they had ships that were raiding the Spanish gold. And then there's Virginia. And some thought that maybe Virginia will be like Port Royal, Jamaica, and we're going to get some of the Spanish gold. We do know that, like, the first load of the first ship that they filled up with stuff, it was with iron pyrite, fool's gold. So here are these Virginia settlers filling up this ship full of iron pyrite, and they send it back to England. They go, hey, we struggle. So there may have been a business venture aspect to it, but not with the pilgrims. This is important, and this is unique in the world. So you had the King of England is now Anglican. He's split from the Catholic Church. You have the Puritans wanting to purify the Church of England, and you have these little separatists. And they are not liked by the Puritans, and they're not liked by the Anglicans, and they're meeting in secret, barns and basements by candlelight, sort of like illegal house churches in China or whatever. And they would get arrested and put in stocks, and they'd get whipped, and they'd get... And so a bunch of these pilgrims decide they're going to flee to Holland, and they sell their land, they get their little tickets, they get on the British boat, and right before the boat takes off, the captain robs them and turns them into the police. And here they are, you know. Well, another group of these separatists, these pilgrims, they sell their land, and they arrange for a Dutch ship to pick them up on the coast of England. And so the men are rowing out and piling all the supplies on there. Meanwhile, someone snitched, and the British soldiers come over the hill and capture the women and children who are waiting on shore. And the Dutch captain says, I'm not here to fight a war. We're out of here. He pulls anchor and sails away with the men. You could just imagine the women on shore saying, my husband. For 2 years, they passed those women and children from one court in England to another, putting them in jails. Finally, the judge says, you didn't really do anything wrong. Go home. They go, duh, we sold our homes. We don't have any. And just to get them out of their hair, they put them on a ship and send them over to Holland, where they are reunited with their husband. So there's a happy ending to that chapter. And so now these pilgrims settle in Leiden, Holland, which happens to be the city where the Jews had settled after the Jews were chased out of Spain. And so they were teaching Hebrew at the University of Leiden, and Elder William Brewster was teaching at the University of Leiden. And so the pilgrims had their annual feast at the end of the year, you know, tabernacles. And so they think that may have influenced the pilgrims' Thanksgiving idea. Plus, in Leiden, Holland, they had the annual celebrating of being freed from the Spanish Furies, this Iron Duke that was killing across Holland. And so they would have an annual day of Thanksgiving to God. So these pilgrims, they hear rumors that Spain is going to invade Holland again, which they eventually did. And so these pilgrims decide they're going to flee. And they were going to flee to Guyana, South America, believe it or not. They heard of the perpetual spring, but then they said, wait a second, we don't want to be that close to the Spanish main, because some Protestants from France tried to settle in Florida, and the Spanish wiped them out. And so they decided they were going to settle in Jamestown, which was a king colony, started in 1607. So now we're up to 1620. And so this colony had been going on for 13 years. And these pilgrims think, they asked permission of the king to do their pilgrim religion. He said, no, But they think, look, we're far enough away, 3,000-mile ocean. We'll be able to do our little pilgrim church, and nobody will know about it. They leave Holland, go to England. They decide to leave on two ships, the Speedwell and the Mayflower. Speedwell does not. Speedwell starts leaking. They have to go back to England, recaulk it, go off again. It leaks again. They got to go back. Now they have to consolidate, and they're all on this one little ship, the Mayflower. They've wasted a lot of time. Now they're now sailing in the winter, and the North Atlantic is storming.
All right, we're going
to...
Let's pause right there, because that's plenty dramatic, Bill, and we need to take a break. Because these are stuff. These are things now that people recognize. It's the Mayflower. The pilgrims are sailing, but they're in peril. And when we return, we'll pick it up there and find out just how they made it to land and what they did when they came. This is Sandy Rios in the morning. My guest is Bill Federer of American Minute and author of so many wonderful books, the latest of which is Who is the King in America, which you will want to get. We'll be right back after this, Sandy Rios, on Thanksgiving 2017.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you, wishing you a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving with your family and friends and neighbors. Just with you and thanking God for all of his wonderful blessings this year, and also pledging with you to pray for our neighbors and friends who are having a really tough holiday season because of the loss of loved ones, because of, you know, whatever's happening in their families. These are turbulent times. So in the midst of our celebration, let's remember people who are having problems trying to celebrate, and also look for opportunities to tell them about God's redemption and give them the larger picture, which is, of course, what Bill Federer is doing right now in telling the story of the founding of this country and of our first Thanksgiving. He's giving us the large view of God's work in the world and in history. So Bill is an American author. His latest book is Who is the King in America, which I strongly urge you to buy. And by the way, I use Bill's God and Country quotes all the time. I've been using them for, I don't know, 20 years maybe. But they're just like a little, they're not my Bible, because my Bible is my Bible, but it is, in terms of history, a great resource, which I really use all the time. Bill, before we go back to this whole business of the pilgrims being on the Mayflower in peril, could you please just address for a second? We talked about the Reformation, which was we celebrated 500 years of that just last week or in the last 10 days. And what impact did Martin Luther, his translation of the Bible, the hymns, all of it, what effect did it have on this particular group of people?
Very important question. The church model was a hierarchical. So you had the Pope at the top, the bishops, and then the priests, and then the clergy and the laity. Laity were the people, and they had this in-between of the clergy. When the Reformation happened, people could now read the Bible in their own language, and there was this movement to focus on that congregational form of church government. And they looked back to ancient Israel before they got King Saul, and they looked back to the early church when they would have tough decisions. They'd all get together, fast, and pray and vote. And so this influenced Calvin and Knox, the Presbyterians, and the Pilgrims. And so if we can, I'll tie these two together. So the Pilgrims are coming across, and there were three types of colonies. So here you had these kings with their global empires with colonies, and there were three types of colonies. First was a company colony. This is a neat way. The king doesn't have to put out any money. He just gives some rich people a monopoly, and they put all the money and take all the risks, and he gets a portion of whatever comes back in. And so you had the British East India Company, and you had the Virginia Company. But the Virginia Company goes bankrupt. Indian attacks, malaria, starvation, and so they throw it in the king's lap, and he sends over a royal governor. So now it's a royal crown colony ruled directly under the king. Third type of colony is a proprietary colony. The king gives the whole thing as property to a friend. So Lord Baltimore gets all of Maryland. William Penn gets all of Pennsylvania and so forth. So the Pilgrims are coming across. They're going to land in Jamestown. and submit to the government. But because of the winter and the storms, they're 500 miles off coast. The captain tries to go south of Cape Cod. There's what's called the graveyard of ships, a lot of sandbars under the water that ships get stuck on and sink. And so he almost sinks. So he goes back to Cape Cod and says, okay, pilgrims, get off. We're not going to sail anymore. Too dangerous. The pilgrims raise their hand and say, excuse me, we have a question. Who's going to be in charge of us? There's no king-appointed person on our boat. They do something unique. They give themselves the authority to start a government. It's called the Mayflower Compact. We, in the presence of God, covenant ourselves together to form a civil body politic, to pass laws that we shall think most meet or most acceptable, unto which we promise all due submission. This was revolutionary. The whole world was ruled by kings who have all their appointed peoples, and their different types of colonies, you know, proprietary and royal or company colonies. This is the pilgrims giving themselves the authority. It's a little polarity change in the hull of this in the womb of this little Mayflower, from a top-down form of government to a bottom-up form of government. Where did they learn this? From their little pastor, John Robinson. He was not a king-appointed Anglican pastor. He was a separatist pastor, actually considered one of the founders of the Congregational Church. This is a model where everybody in the church fasts and prays and votes. And so what these pilgrims did was they took their church model and made it their government model. And so this influenced the New England colonies. So for 10 years, the pilgrims from 1620, 1630 have their little colony, just a couple hundred of them. These Puritans back in England, the heat is turning up. And so between 1630 and 1640, 15,000 Puritans flee England under John Winthrop, and they settle in Massachusetts. Now in England, they did not like the king telling them how to have church. But once the Puritans got to Massachusetts in such large numbers, they sort of were the government. So they thought, maybe it's not such a bad thing that the government tell the church how to have church, because we're in charge. And that's when you had little pastors like Roger Williams fled from Massachusetts and founded Providence, Rhode Island, and the First Baptist Church in America, saying the government's still not supposed to tell us how to have church. And then you have John Wheelwright founding Exeter, New Hampshire, and John Lothrop founding Barnstable, Massachusetts. And then you have Thomas Hooker, a reverend, a pastor. Puritans say only Puritans could vote. Thomas Hooker said anybody that's a Christian could vote. That difference was enough for him to say, okay, everybody, Saturday, meet in the parking lot with your wagons. We're leaving. And they go hill and dale, and they found Hartford, Connecticut. And the people said, pastor, how do we do the church thing? He gives a sermon in 1638 saying the foundation of authority is laid in the free consent of the people. And then he starts quoting from Deuteronomy. And he's talking this. So what we see is the pilgrim model and the New England model is pastors and churches founding these bottom-up forms of church government with bottom-up forms of community government where everybody gets to vote. And so this became the model for the Declaration of Independence, government by the consent of the governed. And a model for the Constitution that says what? We the people. We're not asking permission from some king. We're doing this. And so we clearly see there's a plaque on a monument in Hartford. And it says Thomas Hooker's congregation had the form of government that became the model for the form of government that our U.S. Constitution is built after. And so there's this direct connection from church government. So in other words, in New England, instead of separation of church and state, it was the pastors and their churches that created the state. How can you tell them not to get involved? But all there is in the community is the pastor and his church, and they're following what the pastor tells them. And so we see this model that began with the pilgrims. And so here, that's why we look to the pilgrim as the origin of America instead of Jamestown. Does that make sense?
Yes, and it's fascinating. Actually, it's really fascinating. And, you know, then so I think about when the Revolution came about, there were so many pastors involved, and that's kind of a mystery to us now because things have changed so much, but you could see where they came from, that it was the church leaders who were community leaders. There just wasn't a separation, which is what you described so well. Bill, all right, so the first Thanksgiving that we actually celebrate happened in 1621. So where does this fall, and geographically, where did that fall?
Right. So here they land in Plymouth Rock, Provincetown. They get off. Half of them die the first winter. The men are out there building their little, you know, structures, and they're sweating, and they're catching ammonia, and they die, and they bury them at nighttime because they don't know what the Indians to know how weak they are. And the next spring, they would have not survived Out of the woods comes an Indian speaking to them in perfect English. Can you imagine the dismay on their faces?
No, I can't imagine.
His name is Squanto. So what happened is you had these Dutch and English, it's French boats going up the coast of America and fishing, luring Indians on board, and then taking them to Spain and selling them into slavery. And so here we have Squanto. He's a slave, and he's purchased by some monks in Spain, given freedom, hitchhikes his way across Europe to England, and he works for a company in England for several years, finds a fishing company in Newfoundland, and they give him a ride over, and then he's directing them, and then finally he finds a fishing company boat to drop him off at Massachusetts at Cape Cod, only to find all of his family's dead. The whole village is dead. What happened? William Bradford writes that 3 years earlier, a French ship was shipwrecked right at Cape Cod, and the sailors got ashore, but the Indians never left watching them and dogging them till they got the advantage of three or four, whom they sent from one sachem chief to another, making sport with them, using them worse than slaves. Anyway, some of them must have had some illness. The Indians caught it, and no immunity. It wiped them out. So thorough was the wiping out that the other tribes refused to take that land. So in a sense, the Pilgrims landed at one spot on the eastern seaboard that was uninhabited. Well, Squanto, had he not been kidnapped, he probably would have been killed. So it's sort of providential, but he gets off and he was living with another tribe. And then in that spring, March of 1621, you could imagine somebody coming into his teepee saying, "Hey, Squant, there's some English people trying to start a settlement at your old stomping ground." He walks out of the woods and he says, "Oh, you guys from England? Yeah, I used to live there. Yeah, you know, St. Paul's Chapel. Yeah, the Wharf Street. Yeah, I know it." And then he said, "Oh, I grew up at this spot. Yeah, right over the hill is a spring. This is how you catch the fish. This is how you make popcorn. This is how you catch eels." And so William Bradford says he was a special instrument sent of God for their good beyond their expectation. He showed them how to catch beavers. It took them 40 years worth of beaver skins to pay off the investors that paid for their boat ride. They had one of the ships captured by the Muslims in the English Channel. They had their, you know, and so Squanto was really helped to save their little settlement. Now, it's interesting. 2 years later, William Bradford says that they were sailing through one of the parts of the Bay of Cape Cod, but a storm comes up, and he says that it was so violent they had to put in at Manamoyac Bay. And he says, "Here, Squanto fell ill of Indian fever, bleeding much at the nose, which the Indians take for a symptom of death. It says he bequeathed several of his belongings to his English friends, and then begged Governor Bradford to pray for him that he would go to the Englishman's God in heaven."
Wow.
Now, these Englishmen, pilgrims, they were Christian. And here he says, "Look, I've been around you guys for 2 years. I want to go to your God." I believe he became a Christian. And but just a fascinating history of how his providential, God's prepared him. Sometimes you go through pains in life and you think, you know, God is... You know, Squanto went through these pains. He just kept wanting to go back to his family. Gets there, they're all gone. But God used him in such a way. So sometimes God uses the struggles we've been through so we can minister to others.
Yes.
One last thing I wanted to throw in is their experiment with communism. Do I have a minute or two?
Sure. You have a minute or two.
So the Pilgrims had a company where they borrowed money. This company bylaws that everything was owned in common for 7 years in ye common stock. All fishing and trading and catching of beaver skins goes into the common stock and you live off it. Well, after the first year, nobody wanted to get out and plant. I mean, they're sick, their kids are dying. And so William Bradford scraps it. And he says, "Look, everybody gets their own plot of land. Whatever grows on, it's yours. And then somehow or another, we'll find a way to pay back these investors." And he says, "Now everybody's motivated to get out there and plant it." And so he actually calls it this system of communism that goes back to Plato, who said everything would be owned in common. He says, doesn't work. And so he says, you know, women objected to having to wash other men's clothes. And but he says, now the women would gladly go out into the field and work. Why? Because they benefited from it. So again, they experimented with communism.
It didn't work, just like the first century church. Hey, Bill, in the final minutes we have here, as a historian, why do you think it's important, because I know you do, that we repeat this history, that our kids, our parents of the kids now, grandparents, know this story and repeat it?
Well, they came over here because they wanted the freedom to worship God. They didn't want the government dictating to them what was right, what was wrong. They wanted to go back to the scriptures. We're under the same assault today. We have the government saying, okay, we're going to change the definition of marriage, and you got to go along with it, or we're going to punish you. We're going to say that, you know, you got to force you to do stuff, bake cakes and be a photographer for, a gay wedding with against your... we're seeing the same things that the Pilgrims faced today that they did. And we need to realize that the very core that brought them over here was this freedom to worship God. Goes back to this idea where God is a God of love. He wants us to love him back, but he can't force us, because the moment he forces us, it's not love. It's maybe obedience or submission. Get your head chopped off or whatever, if you don't obey. God's not interested in that. He's interested in this mystical thing. He loves you, wants you to love him back, but for your love back, to be loved, it must be voluntary. So our founders based this freedom of conscience on this idea that our worship and love of God is only valued if it's voluntarily given. And so it's not like Islam. It's not like, these other cultures or the kings of Europe that would burn people at the stake for not believing the way they did. This idea of freedom of conscience was birthed really in America. And it's based on this concept that God is love, and our love response is only valued if it's freely given. So Thomas Jefferson, all of them, wanted to set up this system of government where it's freedom of conscience. So we
yes.
need to defend that and not let the government encroach.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what we're in the midst of doing now. And we thank God that we are still free and that we can tell this story to our children and preserve the freedoms that the Pilgrims and others before us and God's intervention gave us. Thanksgiving 2017. Enjoy it, each and every one of you. Bill Federer, thank you. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.